Okay, so this evening I want to explore a little bit about this figure, Padmasambhava, that we've got on the shrine. And particularly, I'm not going to explore very much about him, or well, I don't plan to, we'll see what happens. But also I want to explore a symbol that he's often associated with, a sort of place that he's often associated with, a sort of mythical but also literal place that he's associated with, which is the cremation ground, the ground where people are cremated. I just want to explore those two symbols a little bit more this week. But before we do that, I want to ask you to do a little bit of a reflection. So I'm going to invite you to do something a bit challenging. So don't do it if you don't want to, but the invitation's there. What I want you to do is reflect on any experience that you've had which has been of death. Now obviously you're still here, so I kind of presume it will mean bereavement or loss, or maybe it's a brush with death, or maybe it's something like illness, or maybe you could take it a little bit more metaphorically, and instead of literal kind of death, you could think in terms of loss, an experience of loss. Loss could be the ending of a relationship, or a marriage, or a job, or some part of your identity being lost. And if you haven't had an encounter with death, either in that literal sense or in the more broader sense of loss, then just take a moment to reflect on what is your view about death. What do you think about death? But if you have had some sort of encounter, see if you can just bring it to mind. And see if you can bring to mind what that experience was like while you were going through it, but also how it left you. What did it mean for you in your life? So only do this if you can do it without... I don't want you to all get really despondent. But I do want us to take these experiences seriously. So if you want to, just sit in your meditation posture, and just for a few minutes we're going to reflect. As you settle into your body, notice the breath. And if there was any sense of metta in the meditation that we've just done, see if you can connect with that sense of well-wishing in the body, in your experience. So as you relax into the body, see if you can bring to mind an experience of what I'm calling death, but it could be a loss of some sort. And see what comes to mind first. Don't try and think about it too much. Loss could be a literal physical loss, or some sort of loss of identity. Just notice what arises in both the mind, but also stay connected with the heart center in your body and the belly. You could ask yourself what the effect of that experience was on you. How were you changed? Staying in your body and in touch with the heart center. Just seeing what happens. You don't have to think of answers. You just let any reflections arise if they do. Opening your eyes again, sitting comfortably. Good, so thank you for indulging me in participating in something that's quite challenging, I imagine, and can be quite sobering, and not something that you get asked to do every day, probably. So, of course, you don't have to share anything if you don't want to, but if anybody would be willing to, I'd be really interested to hear perhaps what your reflections, what happened. And particularly to hear if you had any thoughts about how this experience of loss changed you, what effect it's had, if it has had an effect on your life. Yeah. See if anybody wants to say something. If not, I'll say something. Bereavement, and it's close to you, throws a perspective. Well, it throws things into perspective, doesn't it? And relationships are something that we know are valuable, but often we take people for granted. Or at least I think I do. And there's something about bereavement that makes you wake up to the importance of other people. Thank you. Yes.
I faced quite a bit of contradiction when I was doing this little reflection because I have had a friend who died unexpectedly, and I also had a kind of near-death experience myself. And I had a similar experience to what he said, in that it made me wake up to a lot of things, and it gave me a lot of drive to do the things I want to do. So if I'm about to face something difficult, my first instinct is, you're going to die at some point, so you have to go with it.
Yes.
But
yes,
the contradiction is
that
I'm also currently going through a very transient phase where I'm re-exploring a lot of my values and wishes.
Yes.
So that in itself is sort of what you said, to explore the loss of a part of your identity, for example.
Yes.
It's tremendously difficult. Yes. To the face of most people, it would be easier than a lot of other things I've done, but for me it's incredibly difficult.
Well, I don't underestimate what you're saying. I have experiences of my own where my values have shifted, and I think it can be the most challenging thing.
Yeah.
I think what you've said isn't contradictory to me. They're both true. One experience I think that is common is, yes, that we wake up to what's most important. It's like the values become clearer, and to then start reorientating our life by those values, to actually make changes, can be tremendously challenging, tremendously difficult, scary. There's a real sense that we'll lose who we are. There's something very scary. Even if we know that the values that we're moving towards or the changes that we're making are for the best. I feel that. I feel that myself. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. I think that's you've brought out two very important sides of things. Yes. Is that you? Yes. Hi.
You,
yeah. Yeah.
Not very long ago, I lost my husband. He was very ill. We knew he was going to die.
Yeah.
And when he actually died, it was nothing like I imagined. I was with him.
Yeah.
And I, for 3 or 4 years, to this day, watched him go slowly.
Yeah.
And the actual death was very calm.
Yeah.
Very controlled.
Yeah.
It was actually it was an incredible experience.
Yeah.
And after his passing, I've just come out of it feeling very, very strong.
I
feel that I have strength that I never had before.
So that's not what you would have expected, is it? That's not what you would have expected.
I don't think I'd be able to breathe with that.
Yes, Yes. There's an expectation, I think, that we have of such loss, bereavement, when it's so close to us, that it will be the end of our world, that we couldn't imagine carrying on. And it's not always like that. That doesn't mean that it's easy, but it's not unmixed sometimes.
No, it's not easy, and I sometimes feel enormously vulnerable.
Yeah.
It's a balancing act.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm strong.
Yeah.
I know that I've got a strength in me that I never knew I had.
Yeah, yeah. Through that, the adversity of that experience, the sheer difficulty of that experience, you've become stronger. Yeah. And also what you said about his actual passing away.
It was an incredible experience.
Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah.
It really, really was.
Yeah.
Stays with me.
Yeah.
I can talk about it easily. Don't fall apart. It was I would say the most incredible experience I've ever experienced.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. That's lovely to hear.
Calm.
Yeah.
And controlled.
Yeah.
And I watched it, you know.
Yeah. No, I do understand. Thank you. Yes, you had your hand up.
Yeah, just briefly. I had a year where 4 people very close to me died in succession.
Oh.
2 parents, a boyfriend, and 1 other.
Yes.
Friend.
Yes.
And what I have to say is that there was variable the effect.
Of course.
But that what I got left with, apart from a residual resentment about this happening to so many people.
Of course, yeah.
The resentment went, but that actually it left a very positive sense of urgency about living life in quite a different kind of way.
Yeah.
Living it with a residue of what those people might have done.
Yes.
Had they survived.
Yes.
They weren't all old.
Yes.
And 1 or 2 of the deaths weren't very nice.
Yeah.
Were they pleasant to watch?
Yeah.
They were painful. There were people in pain.
Yes, yes.
Which, you know. But 2 weren't. So there was, you know, but I got left with a feeling that, you know, and I still feel this, funnily enough, 4 years later when I think of the events around those deaths,
yes,
is that there's an urgency and preciousness,
yes,
about using what you have, using,
yes,
your time.
Yes, yes, I think that's right.
In the most, you know,
yeah,
compassionate and decent way.
Exactly. So I think it throws us back at its best if we can make something of the loss. It throws us back, it can do at least, on, well, what are we going to do with our life? And bring some urgency to that question, knowing that it's finite, knowing that we don't know how long we've got. What are we going to live for? How are we going to live? And I think that can be the most precious experience. It can also be one of the most difficult experiences. But I do think can be a really valuable human experience to have to question that. I felt very fortunate in some ways that I had to question that early when I was 11 when my dad died, and although that was a very painful experience, it did start me questioning, and is a strand that led me to the Dharma. More recently, my mum died, and she died very sort of well and sort of easily, as it were, and was ready to go. It was timely, whereas my dad was very young. Also, my mum had been meditating for about 30 years, and she didn't resist in any way. She was happy to go, as it were. And my own experience of her death, after I've been practicing for about 20 years, was very different, markedly different to the loss of my dad. I'm a different man now to the 11-year-old boy, and the Dharma has given me a perspective where I could well, I can't describe why, but her death was one of the most joyous experiences of my life. It wasn't without its sadness and loss, and I miss her, but it was also one of the most real encounters with life that I can remember, where I was vitally in touch with the truth of life, which is that it's impermanent, and vitally in touch with the truth of the Dharma, which is pointing to that impermanence, and I think it's saying to us, make use of what we've got, the time that we've got. And for me, because I was in a position, am in a position to try and practice the Dharma, it just, I felt incredibly fortunate. I felt blessed that not only have I been shown that the Dharma is true and I need to practice it, but I'm in a position to. I'm in a position to. And how blessed can a human being be? So I'm not saying that that's, that, you know, it's all roses by any means, but I do think there's sometimes loss and bereavement can really surprise us sometimes. And I think particularly if we're meditating, particularly if we've got a dharmic practice, we've got some sort of, potentially, we've got some sort of framework, perspective, to hold a very difficult and painful experience within, to make meaning out of it, if we can. I just want to say thank you to all of you who have spoken. It would be, well, thank you for sharing something that is so personal and important, so sort of freely. You know, I'd like to hear more, but I want to also move on to explore this within the Dharmic context. Forgive me for not giving you more time if you were about to speak. So the reason I wanted to start with this is that Padmasambhava is a figure from the Buddhist tradition who's particularly associated with transformation of difficult experiences. Difficult experiences, as it were, in life, and also difficult energies and forces and impulses within our own hearts and minds. Padmasambhava is this magician of a figure who transforms difficulties, demons, as it's in the Tibetan tradition, it's a magical tradition. Medieval Tibet was full of magic, and he transforms demons. Demons sort of external to us and demons within us, and he transforms them. He doesn't destroy them, which is interesting. He doesn't destroy darker forces or energies. He transforms them to the service of the Dharma. He uses the energy that's in those experiences and liberates them in the service of the Dharma, which is very, very different to how demons might be seen in a theistic tradition, where they're in opposition to the good, and have to be destroyed or shunned or, you know, avoided. Whereas Padmasambhava actually goes and finds the demons. He looks for them actively in the world, so that he can transform them. And traditionally, he finds the demons in the cremation ground. So the cremation ground in India, in Nepal, probably in other Asian countries, when somebody dies, and this still happens in India, they're taken to a cremation ground. It's not that they're a nice sanitized crematoria that you just press a button. The body is carried normally with its face exposed, so you can look at the face, It's carried through the town or the village, I mean this would be the tradition, to the cremation ground. I remember going to Varanasi and seeing some of the burning ghats on the banks of the river Ganges, and this still happens. And then the body is taken and a funeral pyre built, very sort of simple funeral pyre built, and the body placed upon the pyre, and all the family, loved ones, etc., gather round, and then the fire's lit, and people gather round and watch the body turn into ashes and bone, and they watch that transformation. As if it's sort of part of life rather than something to be sort of denied. It's not sanitized, it's not hidden away. Death is much more part of life, and I think that's true even in India today. Whereas in our culture we tend to be we tend to sanitize it or to not look at it, not really face it, literally and sort of emotionally. So you've got these cremation grounds where bodies are burning. In charnel grounds, in some traditions, maybe it happens in India still today, there wasn't a cremation. Bodies were just left to decompose and to rot and to be eaten by vultures or jackals or other animals that frequented the charnel ground. And so in these places you would just have death all around you. And it's in these places that Padmasambhava is said to have practiced, he's said to have gone. And even today, Sangharakshita talks in this book of meditators, yogis, going to these charnel grounds and meditating on death. There's a traditional Buddhist practice called meditation on the 10 stages of the decomposition of a corpse. And you're meant to watch a corpse decompose over days. And it's probably not a pretty sight. And then meditate on the fact that this is part of the human condition, this is part of life. And from a Buddhist perspective, when you meditate or reflect on death, it's not so that you can become pessimistic or cynical or resentful or depressed. It's not meant to induce negative mental states in us. It's meant to induce, if induce is the right word, something more like an urgency to practice, an urgency to make the most of life, a sense that your values become clearer, so you know what's really important, and you're trying to change your life so that you live by those values. A sense potentially of the sort of indefinable mystery of the human situation. What is going on? We really don't know what death is. And conversely, well, hand in hand with that, we don't know what being alive is. We do not really understand what consciousness is, what the mind is, what it is to be human. We don't understand that existential situation, that predicament that we're in. And the Dharma says that if you penetrate into that mystery, it's not that you'll get an answer at a rational level, it's not a conceptual answer that you're looking for, but you will be transformed. If you penetrate into the mystery of life and death, it'll have a transformative effect. And the effect will always be one that takes you towards liberation, fearlessness, joy, energy, a sense that you are connected with others and connected with life around you, with all life around you. And out of that sense of liberation and joy and energy is said to be born a desire to help all beings, a love, a compassion to alleviate suffering wherever there is suffering. So it's a tremendously positive ideal that is said to be glimpsed or even reached through contemplating the reality of impermanence, the reality of death in its darkest forms. So Padmasambhava is a figure who is pointing us to that fact, that mystery. He's a figure that is part mythical, in that there are definite aspects of him, his how he is, how he appears, also his life story, that are legendary and mythical and symbolic, full of rich symbolism. But there's a part to Padmasambhava that's historical. He does seem to correspond to either one person or maybe several people who seem to have lived around maybe the 8th century in India. And he's credited with taking the Dharma into Tibet. He's the teacher that successfully transformed the land of Tibet into Buddhism, towards Buddhism, to Buddhism. And to do that, he had to tackle the demons in Tibet that were against the Dharma. He had to tackle them head on, evoking them, calling them, naming them, and then transforming their energies into the service of the Dharma. So he's a sort of magician that can do that. And he does that partly in these cremation grounds. So a kind of really, I think a fascinating kind of figure. I'm going to describe him a little bit. He's dressed in these royal kind of robes, or at least some of the robes. He's got three kind of coloured robes. He's got a yellow robe and a blue robe and then a magnificent red robe that is the outer robe. The yellow robe is quite a simple cloth, and it symbolises the robe of renunciation, the robe of ethical practice, the robe of simplicity, of lifestyle, the robe of letting go of all worldly concerns. And then there's this blue robe, which is the robe of wisdom, of seeing things as they really are. Wisdom, when it opens in your mind, it's said to be like the sky in terms of infinite space, but an inner space. The sky, as it were, is a metaphor for spaciousness in our mind. When you see things as they really are, it's like the mind just settles. All the myriad thoughts and emotions of our psyche, our personality, our sense of who we are, all subside, and what we're left with is this bright, clear spaciousness, infinite spaciousness, that's full of, radiant, brimful of energy and love. So the blue robe that he wears is that wisdom, that spaciousness. And then the outer robe is a red robe, and the red robe is the robe of compassion. From this wisdom, from this renunciation, what emerges is a desire to, in a way, make all beings wake up to this incredible experience. Help all beings alleviate suffering. Not alleviate, but just transcend suffering. So he has this capacity to reach down into the world And he does reach down in a quite a direct way in order to help wake us up. One of his legs is sort of reaching down from the lotus. The other leg is sort of sitting in meditation posture on the lotus. But the one leg is coming down into the world, and his eyes are looking directly at you. Some of the Buddha figures have their eyes closed or half closed, but Padmasambhava looks at you, and he looks at you in the eye, and he sees right through. He knows what he's looking at, and it's said to be a very, very challenging experience to see the eyes of the guru of Padmasambhava, to be seen by him, because you can't hide. All of our pretense, all of our masks, all of our trying to put on a show for ourselves and others is stripped away under this gaze that just sees right through. Fortunately, it's a gaze also of compassion. So he sees you in order to wake you up. And on his face there's a smile, but it's a smile which is, well, it's compassion, but it is also a challenge in the smile. There's a challenge. He's not just a cuddly figure. He's looking at you with this slightly wrathful smile that's also challenging you to wake up. He means business, as it were. And he doesn't play around. So, for example, to emphasize that, in his right hand, just cradling by his belly, he's holding a cup, and it's a cup that is a skull, just the top of a skull. Tibetans really love bone ornaments in rituals, and all these bone ornaments in rituals are said to remind you constantly of death, of impermanence. So he's clutching this cup, which he could drink from, which is the top of a human skull, and in it there's this boiling red liquid, which could be blood, but symbolically it's said to be nectar, the nectar of the gods, the nectar of immortality. Because it's through confronting impermanence and death that you transcend. Well, enlightenment is the transcendence of all death. It's said to be the deathless. So there's this nectar of immortality swirling around in this cup that's this human skull. In his other hand, he's holding a vajra. A few weeks ago we heard about the vajra as the diamond thunderbolt of reality that shatters all ignorance, all delusion. He's holding this vajra in a very sort of challenging way, pointing it, as it were. And yes, there's this sense that he could hurl this diamond thunderbolt, if he wanted to, at you. And then in the crook of his right arm is this trident. It's this trident which is rather sort of fearsome. It's got three prongs to it, and then underneath the three prongs there are three severed human heads. One is freshly dead and probably bleeding. The other is decomposing. The next one is a little longer dead and is decomposing. And the third is just a skull. So death is really being confronted. You're being confronted with death. He's joyfully holding this trident. The week before, Subhadramati was talking about the Dakinis, these celestial maidens who dance in the cremation ground. And these Dakinis are his consorts. He dances with these Dakinis, these celestial maidens. And the trident is said to symbolize one of those. It's said to symbolize a Dakini in the crook of his arm. And the Dardanies are sometimes associated with all those powerful energies that we need to harness, release and then harness in order to really make progress towards enlightenment. He's got a head which is, on top of his head is this hat, it's a skull cap, with a vulture's feather pointing up out of it. He's immensely sort of majestic and slightly terrifying as he sort of moves towards you. He's associated with the colour red primarily, predominantly, with all the passion and compassion that enlightenment releases. So that's Padmasambhava as a figure both mythical and semi-historical. There does seem to have been a figure who took the Dharma to Tibet in around the 8th century. And but it's more the symbolic and mythical Padmasambhava that I want to look at. And particularly I want to dwell a little bit more on the symbolism of the cremation ground in which he transforms energies, demons. So one of the symbols of the cremation ground is, well, death, as we've just looked at, or loss in some way, because the cremation ground is an actual place, but it's actually also a symbol. It's a symbol for all of that loss and difficult, potentially transformative encounter that we can have in our everyday lives. Another sort of association with the cremation ground, or perhaps a sort of consequence of dwelling in the cremation ground, is fearlessness. It's interesting that you were talking about having lost your husband, how one of the effects is that you feel stronger, that you feel strong, having faced something that you thought you couldn't face and survived and lived through. One of the effects can be that you become less fearful, even fearless. Fearlessness is a really, really prized quality in Buddhism. It's sometimes something that we overlook as a quality of the enlightened mind, but it's a really, really important one. Confidence, fearlessness, a sense that you can harness your energies and channel them in the way that you want to, and take the creative initiative to do that, sort of despite what others might think. That's really, really important if you're going to really practice the Dharma life. So I'm just going to pause there. So I've said some things about Padmasambhava as a figure, primarily as a sort of symbolic figure, but also he did seem to have historical associations. I've talked about the cremation ground, both literally as it exists in India and Nepal and probably some other Asian countries, and the cremation ground also as a symbol for what we can encounter in our own lives, something that perhaps we even need to seek out in our own lives, although even if we don't seek it, it'll probably find us at some point or other. And then some of the qualities that can arise if we stay in the cremation ground, which is something to do with really seeing what's of value in life, developing the fearlessness or the courage to pursue that, finding within us resources that perhaps we didn't think we had, strength that we didn't know we had, a clarity about what's important, perspective, etc., etc. So let me just pause there and see if there are any questions or thoughts about any of that so far, and whether you feel that this symbolism speaks to you or not? Yeah. Oh. Sorry.
What?
Sorry, I was just a bit chained, right? Matt, yeah, go on.
Why do you think the West is in denial about death? Why has Western culture turned its back on death? Puts it in a cupboard.
It does, doesn't it?
Completely around.
Yeah. I do think that we're in denial about lots of things, but death perhaps is the ultimate thing that we're in denial about, because we do seem to have this myth that we can have it all in life, that we can be really, really completely fulfilled in life if you buy all the right things and get all the right connections and do the right job, and if you're rich enough and successful enough and powerful enough, and as if there's this real kind of materialist assumption that all of those things can make you completely fulfilled. I mean, of course they might, you know, they might be of some value, but there's this myth that they will completely satisfy you. And of course death strips all of that away. It strips that away completely. So advertisers wouldn't like it. We need to be convinced to buy the next iPad or whatever it is. And in order to be convinced to do that, we need to be sold a lie which says that you can have it all if you just do what everybody else is doing. And I think sickness and old age and particularly death fly in the face of that, because they wake us up to real values. Yeah, because if we really reflected on these values, maybe we wouldn't bother about buying so much and destroying the planet in the process. Maybe we'd learn to really appreciate people around us and not be so driven in some of the pursuits that we are driven in. Maybe we'd look to live in a very different way. But our culture has sort of shifted away from real value to something a bit more like Tinseltown, and it's driving that relentlessly. And I think death would really undercut all of that.
Slightly inconvenient, isn't it?
It would be inconvenient. I also think that Christianity has something to do with it. Although many people in our culture no longer identify themselves as Christian, We have a Christian heritage, and in the Christian tradition, death wasn't always seen as positive and part of what makes human life meaningful. It's something to be really kind of feared, unless you're a devout Christian, in which case, you know, you're guaranteed a place in heaven. You're all right. But I think theistic religions can really create, it can demonise death and create this sense of... whereas I think a pagan culture, pre-Christian pagan culture, probably embraced the fact of death a bit more. Yeah, but death is part of life.
I'm not sure that's right. I think
yes.
In other cultures,
yes.
A lot of power is probably given to some priesthood.
Say that again. A lot of power.
Part of other culture, the power is probably given some priesthoods to try to give the answer to people who are still fearing death.
Yes.
I think the fear of death is probably quite universal.
Yes. Oh, I'm not saying the fear isn't universal. I'm just trying to answer Matt's question of why we in the West might not be confronting that. I think the fear of death is...
I don't think many cultures confront it necessarily.
Yes. Well, I think probably most cultures are now sort of more and more, I think you're right probably, but they're more and more influenced by what we think of as Western culture. But I do think that, for example, Indian culture is different. My experience of Indian culture is that death isn't just hidden away. Even how funerals are conducted, it's a more sort of participatory, public, even celebratory affair. Yes.
This might sound like a really stupid question, but did the plague hit India and Tibet and those areas at all? Because I know that in Western culture, historically, that was significant in the attitude that that Europe has developed towards death, and the idea of death no longer means the end of your life. Death means an illness that is threatening the community's livelihood, and that one of the reasons why it was shunned.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think in India you've got the Black Death as in, you know, as we did in medieval Britain, necessarily, but you've had famine, you've had devastation, you know, probably more than perhaps we've faced in the West. Mm. Yeah.
I just wonder if Western cultures kind of less good at kind of containing polarities, you know, where in Eastern cultures are kind of, like in the West, they kind of think we can get rid of evil. You know, the good versus evil. The idea that we can somehow that we don't recognise polarity.
No, that's right.
In the East, somehow they're more able to do that.
I think so. I find the figure of Padmasambhava very interesting in this regard, in that if you were just looking at Christian symbolism, then a lot of what Padmasambhava is associated with would be satanic. You know, a trident, a three-pronged trident with three severed heads. Not what you'd normally worship in a church. It would be associated with all of that stuff that is evil. Yeah. Whereas Padmasambhava in the Buddhist tradition is confronting all the darker forces within us and within the world around us, and saying that we can transform these into the service of the Dharma. I love the fact that he's not saying that you deny these forces. By these forces, for example, I mean hatred and craving, passion, greed, lust, jealousy, anger, cruelty, all of those forces that are more or less dormant within our subconscious or within the human psyche. Padmasambhava is saying there's real energy locked up in that. Yeah, if you deny those forces in you, you remain on the surface of experience. On the other hand, if you just unleash those forces in you, you become a force of destruction and you know, psychopathic possibly. What Padmasambhava helps do, what the Dharma helps do, is unblock them, but help you transform them, help transform the energy in them to something far, far more creative, which is you know, very exciting, and isn't this polarization of lust is evil, etc., etc. Do you see what I mean? Yeah.
This is sort of maybe taking us into slightly different territory, but I've heard here a lot how the Buddha sees humanity is essentially good, and it's always been a stumbling block for me because of the forces that humanity is discussing
as dark,
something constitutional something
they are.
Within us, and it feels like a denial say that humans are essentially good.
I think it's a really good question, and it's one that the Buddhist tradition sometimes wrestled with, and different forms of Buddhism have slightly different takes on it. But what the Buddha did say is two things. One, he said that greed and hatred and delusion, I don't know if you were here for when we were looking at the Wheel of Life, they're right at the center of the Wheel of Life, and he says that they're intrinsic in human beings. In all unenlightened human beings, there is greed and hatred and delusion driving us. All unenlightened human beings are driven by that to some degree or other. And then the other thing he says is that all human beings are capable of transformation, of reaching enlightenment, of completely transforming those forces to the service of something liberating, something transcendent.
How
So both are true. Do you see what I mean? The potential is in all human beings, as is the fact of craving and hatred.
Sorry, no, thank you so much for explaining that. Actually, it's really helpful. But how are these forces conceptualized within us, or is the Buddha not that interested in thinking about how they're conceptualized, you know, as drives, and what are they, energy, what are these forces, where do they come from?
Yeah. He doesn't say where they come from. When he was asked where they come from, he says they don't have a beginning. The tradition would say that we have we have brought them into being from previous lives. That in fact these forces have manifested as this life. Yeah. So the reason that we have carried on as an unenlightened human being is this drive, these drives, and they are seen as drives. They're seen as volitional drives, as energies. He wouldn't have used the word energy, that's a modern concept. But they're seen as, the word is sanskara. They're seen as volitional drives. And then in different ways they're symbolised, and particularly the Tantra uses images. And in the Wheel of Life, there are three animals at the centre, with the cock, the snake and the pig, and the cock representing craving, the snake hatred, and the pig delusion. So, and often they're symbolised in other ways. So yes, you've got sort of, they're conceptualised as primal drives. And they're not just at a conscious level. The Buddha wouldn't have used this language, but I because he wouldn't have known about evolution, but I think that they're sort of almost at that biological level. They're part of what's, they're part of what the survival instinct is about.
I'm thinking of the Freudian
rivalry. Yeah. So they're very, 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 very deep. And Buddhism is saying that we can work to transform them, but you are working at that primal level, ultimately. Yeah. So maybe we'll start wrapping up there. So there's more to say, much more actually to explore about both Padmasambhava and the cremation ground that he dances in, he plays in. But I think what we've touched on is some of the essence of that. We've touched on looking at what happens or what can happen when you encounter death, which is encountering, if you like, the cremation ground. Bhante Sangharakshita talks about the cremation ground as any crucial situation in your life, any crucial situation that you can't just avoid and turn away from and pretend isn't there. There will be those situations, whether they're illness or sickness or illness or death or, I don't know, loss of some sort. We will encounter situations which will not go away just because we'd like them to. That is us encountering the cremation ground. In that cremation ground, yes, there's challenge, but there's the possibility of transformation right in the heart of that crucial situation, which is what we don't want. There's the possibility of liberation, of transformative liberation, where if you really are able to stay with the forces that are unleashed in you and outside of you, then there's a potential that you can harness those forces and become stronger, wiser, clearer about what's of meaning and value, more compassionate, more connected with all of life, move towards Padmasambhava, move towards the Buddha. So there's something in that confrontation which is pure gold, and he's pointing you at that and encouraging you to stay with that. And for that to really happen in our lives, we will need to be practicing. If we're not practicing, if we're not trying to work with our minds, probably, not always, but probably, we won't be able to stay with that crucial situation in a transformative way, or we're less likely to be able to. Yeah. So I'll leave it there that for now. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.